So whatever we're doing in Dhamma practice, whether it's meditating or serving, working, teaching, we're doing, it's always about training, cultivating, purifying, looking into the heart. So this is the center of it all. We say heart is the center of intentions, motivation, of being affected, of being touched, of being moved, of perceptions, that's the senses of our interpretation of this experience, that basic sense of feels, things feel good, things feel right, you know, things feel awkward or whatever, that intuitive sense. So this is really the big center of our lives, and our thought processes are there to just to serve that. You know, you feel a strong motivation to do something, and then you think about it. You put your head into it. And it's important to have this strong quality of heart, because otherwise your thinking mind just kind of drivels around. Driving yourself nuts, because you've got it, so you've got to use it. And you also, but it's not really that. Although that can seem to be the problem, your thinking mind, this incessant buzzing and nattering, it isn't really the problem. The problem is the problem, and the answer is the heart, because the thinking mind is thinking because the heart is confused, or uncertain, or not focused, or half asleep, or restless, or not tuned in. So it's in this unsteady state, a thinking mind just starts, doesn't have anything to establish itself upon, wandering. Now the heart energy, like all energy forms, all is body, heart, thinking mind, is always circling. Generally it's circling anyway for an ordinary person. It means it's, things are being worked through it. There's different sort of moods, feelings, intentions, perceptions are happening. Sometimes we don't really notice them because we're actually in gear. We're already directed towards something, so everything that's coming through our hearts, our intentions, we're feeling clear, confident, or in a hurry, or urgent, or we're meditating. We've got a certain motivation. So that gives you a certain sense of continuity, because it's like, even though things are moving, they're moving on the same track. You know, you're getting new ideas coming up, and you're in that kind of in that flow of it. But often it's when you contemplate that, you realize actually all those senses and moods and impressions are still shifting and changing. When you start to unplug a little bit from having that much to do, you can sort of see how, you get memories and impressions and inclinations, and it'd be nice to do this, or suddenly things come up from the past, it seems. You know, nostalgia, regrets, or we've got rehashing some incident or another. It's like the whole thing is just continually oscillating, moving around and around and around, seeing if there's anything there to pick up on. You know, anything there to kind of get obsessed about, get interested in, get motivated by, and just doing this stuff all the time. And based upon that, your thinking mind starts to pick up ideas and so on. So this is a continual shifting movement. That's the way it is. That's what they do. Now, towards balance and some sense of stillness, or where we feel more comfortable and settled, what really occurs is that movement is entrained. It's like a drum beat. It's going on one particular theme all the time, so it's much steadier. And it's still moving, but it's actually moving in the same. It's not scattered. So this is the purpose of what we call mindfulness, is you keep redirecting yourself towards a particular theme. And mindfulness is one of those buzzwords which can be applied to all kinds of things, which just means basically the ability to bear something in mind. And this could be bearing, you know, oh, cooking the dinner, how's that getting on? So every now and then you're thinking, is it time to put this in? Is it burning? I've got to switch the oven on. You're mindful of cooking the dinner. So it's not just some meditation technique, it's a basic function of the mind. You know? Or you can be mindful that it's, you've only got, you know, it's getting towards Friday, you've got to have something finished by the weekend, so you're mindful of that. So that it sets up a particular, something you're bearing in mind, that gives your life a certain, or your day a certain shape. It's giving a certain direction. So in a way it kind of forms a particular pattern. Now in meditation we are developing that mindfulness. You know, in fact, mindfulness is supposed to be a continual factor of the mind. It's always there, it's ever present. But it's normally only present, we're mindful of something for a little while, like, you know, candle burn, think, you know, how to light a match, put it there, and then it's gone. You know. But with meditation, we're extending that quite deliberately to quite long periods of time. You know, like mindful of breathing in and out, or, you know, for long periods of time, you know, for minutes at a time, sometimes half an hour at a time, hour, mindful of walking up and down, mindful of the body, mindful of these. So you're just placing that in your, that's your program, that's your kind of, it's your thing you're coming back to again and again, in order to really understand it, in order to stabilize the heart, in order to shift gear so that the mind isn't continually scattering this way and that way. Now the point about mindfulness is it's a universal quality that accomplishes everything we do, and it's a mild form, you might say, of concentration. It means that you've got one particular focal point. It's be continually able to be readjusted because you've got another quality called sampajanya, or full awareness, which says, wait a minute, I've been doing that. No, that thing that I'm focusing on, actually, how's that affecting me? So you've got something that's giving you a feedback on that. So say you're, you know, mindful of cooking the dinner, so you're going through that. But you're not automatic. You're aware of, oh, wait a minute, some other factors have come in. So there's a certain openness to look at other factors, like, somebody's phoned to say they're coming late, so you don't need to have the dinner ready. Or you've run out of a particular ingredient, so you've got to change the recipe. So you've got this sampajanya, means you're open to new factors coming in that actually have an effect on that mindfulness, you know, what you're being mindful of. So it's not a completely obsessive quality. So we're not trying to be obsessive when we meditate, you know, like only with thing, but you're mindful, say, of breathing, but you're aware of actually what's happening in the body, what's the effect of this? Am I getting tight? And am I getting obsessive? Am I feeling more relaxed? Am I feeling more comfortable? And what's my general attitude? Am I getting forceful? Am I one of these got to get it right attitudes coming in, you know, where the meditation becomes a kind of another Olympic struggle to perfection? No, let's let go of that one. So because of this sampajanya, or full awareness, you're able to acknowledge any kind of random input, also these input that comes from our psychological attitudes, like our perfectionism, like our self-criticism, like our wish to control everything, like our impatience. You know, I've been doing this for 3 whole minutes, surely I should be enlightened by now, you know. When's it going to shift? So you start to acknowledge some of these tendencies coming in, and that's what you want to know about, really. That's one of the reasons why we focus on a particular object, because around any particular object, you stay with it, you're going to start to see all of your psychologies playing on that, you know. Yeah. It doesn't matter what it is, if it's kind of feeding the cows, you'll start to see the days when you don't want to do it, the days when you're really, really good at it, the days when you want to get an award for it, the days when you're fed up with it, you know, the days when you're trying to find new interesting ways to feed a cow. The days when you feel sorry for yourself for having such a rotten job. The days when you regard it as a bodhisattva inclination for the welfare of all sentient cows. You know, you're going to, all these things are going to come running through. And you want to know them, you know, because these are the programs, these are the schemas, these are these that actually are there kind of structuring your life. And some of them are quite destructive. Some of them are quite destructive, some of them are very beautiful, some of them are destructive. So the perfectionism can be quite destructive. You know, impatience is quite destructive. You know, and we see all kinds of stuff coming up, you know. Like we set something up as an ideal and then when we fail. And something just goes into that. We don't actually make reasonable standards of, well, I'll try this a little bit. We aim for the sky and we can't make it. We feel failure again. Rather than saying, well, actually, could you just, you know. And one of the main themes in meditation is, which is a really beautiful thing for jamming a lot of these afflictive programs, is just a moment at a time. Rather than, I've got to do this for the next 10 days, you know. Just, no, you don't. You don't. You've only got to breathe, you've only got to do the next out breath. And the next in breath. And a half an in breath. You've only got to go through the next moment. And this sometimes, just this attitude, helps to deflate this wave of panic or of making a big. Obstacle out of life, so you know, because this is what these afflictive programs bring up. They bring up these ghosts and phantoms of endless struggle. You can't make it. It's bigger than you are. And no, that actually even is presenting this scenario of some future, but actually that's only happening now, isn't it? And you feel that, and you start because you study some of these. While you're mindful and aware, as you're studying that, you know, oh, I've got to do this, another walking, another sitting, another walking, another sitting, God, another 45 minutes of this. And that's interesting. Let's take a photograph of that piece of landscape. Because this is something, you know, that sense of dogged duty, boring, grey, endless struggle onwards. Yeah. Wow, you know, comes up, felt in the heart, quite meaningful, you know. This is what the difference between work as a chore and work as creativity, between work and play, isn't it? You can play all day, work, oh, grind, boring, drudging, you know. Isn't it? Where did that one come from, you know? Is it out there? Or is it in here? So we start to see some of these afflictive programs, and you want to know them. And you want to know them, and the feeling, sometimes you feel them in your body, you feel a certain tightening. Generally the telltale signs are a tightening, a deadening effect, a dreariness, or sometimes a speediness. As you get panic, oh, I've got to get on. Or you get this dreary feeling of this goes on forever, you know, a heaviness to it. Oh, what's that, you know? And we come back, stop, pause, widen, breathe in, breathe out, widen, soften, just take it a moment at a time. Yeah. So, you know, then you start to work through this. Otherwise we can actually feel that interpretation of our activity is a true thing. The meditation is boring, endless work, big project, you've got to be really good at it, enlightenment's way off in the distance somewhere, you're not going to make it this lifetime anyway, kid. So, you know, and you can believe in that. So when these programs come up and they're seductive and they're also insidious, they kind of creep in. And they're global, like suddenly you look around, the world looks grey, your heart feels like that, it becomes very, they take over everything, and you're in that. So, you know, what you can know is you can know the change of perception, you can know a certain dulling or flattening of the energy, it's no longer bright or vibrant or alive, it's kind of closing, it's closing and hardening. And life is hardening and closing down. Yeah. That's called death, or the path to it. Yeah. It's the beginning of it. You know, it's the beginning of the death process. Everything kind of ossifies into, and then you gradually, if you follow it, that's where it goes. Psychologically, spiritually, creatively, emotionally. We get stuck in some routine, we feel helpless with it, we don't feel we can break out of it, we start to feel we're living underneath our life, kind of just run along by it. So, you know, you want to know, it's the next moment is the unknown. Bear that in mind, the next moment is the unknown, you don't know. You don't have to have it planned. You don't know the next moment, do you? Do you know what's going to happen in 1 minute's time exactly? Do you know what thought you'll have? What sound will be present? What physical sensation will be present? What I'm going to say? No. But you can go, oh, another evening, here we go. You know? There's no such thing as another anything. There's no another. Nothing ever happens again. It's just, you know, really, does it? It's something new, something shifting. So what is it that so closes our life down? And we don't have a word for it, but you can feel it. Notice it. And particularly in retreats where you've got a routine, routines are the ideal ground to watch that happen. You know, morning, first morning quite fresh, by the afternoon you've already got this sense of routine, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, next day 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, here we go, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, they're ideal, they're setups to watch that process of dying. The death of the heart. So why do we do it? Because you want to know it. You want to actually almost enter that place, and still, you know, it's actually the next moment is the unknown. You know, come out of it. Get over it, you know. And there's a certain stabilizing effect of and a deepening that occurs when, instead of continually trying to do something new all the time, you realize new all the time is the basic, is what's happening already. You don't have to do something new, it's already happening. You just got to get fresh enough and clear enough to sense it. You know? And it deepens us beyond this kind of scattering of, well, done this for a whole day, where's the next thing, you know? Switch on something. It deepens you, because you start to uproot some of these tendencies through that, checking them. Ill will, self-criticism, another very strong one for people. Fault-finding mind, self-critical. Inner tyrant, we call it. The voice, like a little parrot, sits in your shoulder telling you how you're never doing it good enough. Hmm? you're thinking too much. You're not really resolute enough. You always give in to pain, don't you? You're not really committed. Yeah. And you're dull as well, sleepy. You know. I think actually your practice is really pretty half-hearted, if you ask me. You know, I mean, in fact, basically you shouldn't even be here, you know. I mean, people like you are the blight of the planet. You want to hear this one go? It can really draw on the drama, this one. It's a little program. You know, some people have it very strongly ingrained. Other people have worked through it. It's nagging. And it seems to be something to do with the superego function, you know. And the thing it can never do, it can never say, oh, that was good. Or, well, that wasn't so good, but try again next time. It can't do that. It can't congratulate, it can't enjoy. It's a kind of sour, joyless thing. Yeah. So you have to contemplate that one when it's coming up. Getting impatient with yourself. Yeah. Feel the energy of it, how trapped it is. I found with this inner tyrant, it's quite useful. I'd even try to imagine what it looked like. This little voice in my head. It looked kind of, always looked so sour. Like Scrooge, you know, in Charles Dickens, kind of sour thing. And so I'd start to talk to it. You know, like, how you doing, tyrant, today? You know. Look what I've just done. I don't care either. You know, just to kind of get free of that think there's something to achieve. Yeah. So what we really are trying to achieve, if anything, is the ability to, you know, sense some of these programs and dissolve. So every time, you know, you're following your breathing, the new one of these things takes over. Notice yourself getting into that kind of little piece of drama, psychodrama, how it feels, the energy of it, the voices in it, the scenarios it paints. Don't go stay there too long because it's pretty convincing. And just get the sense of, who is this? Who is this? You know, how is it now? How is it feeling in your body? How does your heart feel? Do you feel warm? Do you feel this is for your well-being, for anybody's well-being, conducive to peace of mind? No. Is there any reason why you want to keep this one going? So you don't try and shove it away, just always pause with it. Is there anything that you want to keep this one going for? Just ask that question. Is it doing any? Is it going any useful? Do you want to keep it going? Yeah. And then there's that moment when you just relax out of that, breathing in, breathing out, relax, go back, let it drop away into your breathing. So it's just like that. That's why we use something like breathing, because it's got this two fundamental energy processes: one of releasing, letting go, one of brightening, beginning again. So every time you come up against one of these obstacles, don't be in a hurry with it. Don't try and dismiss it, but just almost pause with that. Widen your attention. Slow down, widen your attention, feel your body. Just consider, is this worth keeping going? It's time to say goodbye to this one for a few moments. Widen, soften, relax, come back in, breathing out. because they always have this tendency to contract you. You tighten up, you get driven. So you're coming out of the driven state by the pause, you're coming out of the tightened state by widening, and you're returning with that out breath. Mm. Oh, this is a cleansing process. It's also useful to have, when we talk about heart energy, to deliberately pick up and be mindful of particular intentions. So the fundamental intention, or the fundamental check is, as I've mentioned it before, is this for my welfare? Is this for the welfare of others? Is this conducive to Nibbana? And Nibbana will say roughly peace or stopping suffering or the release, you know, however you want to put it. For my welfare, for the welfare of others, this is conducive to Nibbana. This is the basic heart question. And then you start to sort of, you can bring up, there's an aspiration. Now aspiration is a heart energy, it's very important. This sense of something that we could be motivated by, that by itself kind of gathers us, we're interested in, we feel this is worthy of being borne in mind. This is something beautiful to bear in mind. And you start to focus on that. One of our aspirations, there are particular aspirations called parami, perfections or furtherances. There are 10 of them, I won't go through the whole lot tonight anyway. But a couple we might consider tonight. One is generosity. One is morality, non-abuse. Non-abusing yourself, non-abusing others. Generosity, which we touched on earlier. Of course, there's generosity in terms of material things. What is the gesture of generosity? Whatever it is, whether it's a spoonful of rice, whether you're offering, as you do at the mealtime, taking your time to actually contemplate the sense of, very simple sense of just feeding another person when you put food in my bowl, in the teacher's bowl. Why, in fact, we kind of encourage that. A big man like me, surely I could do it myself. Not a baby anymore. But this is one of the most fundamental perceptions that most immediately connects, is feeding another person. This is the most fundamental thing that human beings can immediately resonate with, because it's so important. We've all been fed, and it's the most normal thing we do, isn't it? When you want to invite somebody to come round for dinner, you don't say come round and do the washing up, you say come round for dinner. Come round and have a cup of tea, have a cup of tea and a biscuit, something like that. You want to offer them something nourishing, you know, very simple thing. And we enjoy that. And it's a, you know, basic currency, you might say, of connection. You know, I want to offer something to you, simple form of nourishment, and that makes me feel good. You know, it's for my welfare, it's for your welfare. Yeah. As it conducive to Nibbana, because it does help to uproot a program or a strong tendency can happen for us, which is isolation, alienation, like a self-contraction, which means which can start out like self-interest. I'm doing things for me, you know, I'm getting my scene together, I've got what I need, I want to have more of this, quite reasonable enough, you know, looking after myself, and yet can lead to the sense of isolation, alienation. I was in Denmark a while back. This was quite a while back, actually. I was talking. They have a very advanced welfare system, social welfare system, whereby, which, yeah, it's great. whereby, you know, if you didn't have work, you could get, you know, nearly 80% of your income that you would do if you were getting a job. If you were getting a job, you're getting 100 kroner. Then if you didn't work, you get 80 kroner, something like that. You know, that's what I mean. And if, and of course, if you were retired, then you, the state would look after you, which sounds really good. And I'm sure there are many good things about it. One of the people was saying, you know, the problem is with this is nobody has to look after anybody anymore. You know, nobody has to look after anyone anymore because it's all done anonymously. And we've got a city of people sitting around in little rooms with their canary, because nobody comes around to see them because they're getting their thing through the door, their check, their payment through the door. Doesn't somebody come around and say, "How you doing?" You know, "Oh well, let's help you out." You know, and so even though materially they're fine, emotionally they're sort of looking out the window, talking to the canary. Because, you know, I think it's in many ways it's an admirable system, but yet, like everything, there's a slight disadvantage in the sense of it's actually much more important to need each other. It's strange because some of our material psychology is to not have to need anybody. You know, I've got my own stuff together, I'm okay, I don't need people. You know, but so, and this certainly for a monk, you know, this can be a big obstacle, accepting other people's offerings. If you're embarrassed, feel you should pay something back, you want something nice, you know, you haven't got anything. You know, people give you things. I mean, the one thing you can recognise is, well, I've not asked for anything, so people are doing it because they want to. But we found, particularly when we started our monastery at Chithurst, we had a lot of surplus tea. We wanted to give some of it away to local people. And they say, "Oh, we can't accept charity." "Well, why not? We do." You know, it's like, it's strange, you know, that sense of, you can feel there was like a barrier of, I don't want to be grateful to you, I don't want to feel embarrassed and grateful, you know, because it means we're connected. I don't want to feel connected to other people, you know, because it's too much emotions happening. Something like that. I mean, there's a certain thing, particularly about some people in Britain anyway, you know, is that but generosity connects us, and helping each other connects us. So just contemplate that the spirit of it, the service, you know. And the beauty of it is it's mostly a gesture of the heart. Because once you can put that one in and be mindful of that, the beauty of it is it's holistic, and you become more generous to yourself. You become less critical, less tyrannical, less demanding. Let's just take it easy for this guy. He's having a hard time. You know, let's give him a bit more time. He's got to work things through. Doing the best he can, you know. You know, he didn't start with a full deck anyway. And it becomes a almost like a, when you cultivate that, then also what's happening is your radar. This way the mind is continually sweeping, is no longer sweeping so much in terms of what have I got, what can I make, what can I get, what can I gain, am I getting anywhere, but how can I offer, what can I offer, how's everybody else doing, how's it going, what's beautiful to do here, what can I give. So it's almost like the heart kind of opens out and we start to feel happy. and that the irritations no longer really stick, because we're a different wavelength. You're not on the me wavelength. So there's enormous benefit that comes through having a program like that, you know, an intention like that established. Then you look at something like, another one is morality, sila. This is very helpful, particularly things like manipulative mind. I won't just kind of wangle that bit, you know, cutting corners, or deceitfulness. When we start being less than truthful to ourselves. About our own, so we're less than truthful to ourselves about what's going on in our minds. There's this famous story of Ajahn Chah's monasteries when they first started up the Western monastery. So originally all the monks were at Wat Pa Pong, which was a Thai style monastery, and after a while Ajahn Chah felt, well, start a monastery just for Westerners, because they got their own culture, their own ways of doing things, and so, you know, they might be better off with each other, because it's a different scene, you know. And one thing, the Thai scene is not really a drink scene. They don't, not just alcohol, they don't have tea and coffee, quite rare. Mostly they have just water, and if there's anything interesting, it'd be something like a Pepsi. So you don't get coffee, or you didn't get coffee at Wat Pa Pong. It wasn't part of their culture at that time. Yeah. But in the Western monastery, you could get coffee, because it was part of their culture. So I was going, oh, I want to go. And they said to Ajahn Chah, I'd like to go to the Western monastery, Wat Pa Nana Chai. He said, why? Because I want to intensify my Dhamma practice. No, you can stay here. If you want, you intensify your Dhamma practice here. You're fine. And then one monk said, I want to go there because I don't want to drink the coffee. And Chah said, okay, fine, you can go. At least this guy's not bullshitting, you know. Go there, you know, find out, you know, let's be honest about what's really going on, you know. Because then if you're being honest, instead of coming up with some kind of waffle, you actually see, you start to contemplate, you know, your desires, your niggliness, your manipulativeness, and okay, there it is. And then, now we can kind of open it up. Everybody has this stuff. We all have covetousness, fancies, greeds, aversions. We don't want to do things that are uncomfortable. Goodness me, is this something so unusual? Let's open it up and look at it, you know, and just get in there. Otherwise, we're never going to clear it. So if we're starting to expect ourselves to start off at this level of sainthood, purity, then we're never going to get anywhere. So truthfulness and non-deceit is a really important thing to develop. And you know, so we put that one in there, morality, being truthful. So in this way you start to sense, you know, things are coming into your mind, and some of them are just, well, so what? Some of them come in with a big, you know, highlights on them, you know, irritation, craving, fantasies of some kind or another. And you're going, you know, and you sort of just try and dismiss it. It comes back again. So then you have to actually make that your object of meditation. So you're mindful of that, and you're mindful of it with this sampajanya quality, like examining it, contemplating it, how it is, breathing through it, feeling into it. What's it about? What's it doing to you? So then, through this process of wisdom, you know, through wise discernment and insight, you look into, you know, what's this actually, you know, is this really going to do me any good? What's it about? How does it feel? What's it doing to me right now? And you see, most forms of what we greed or fantasy is right now is a pretty unpleasant feeling. It always says when you get to that donut, that, you know, whatever it is, you'll be fine. You get there and you'll be fine. But right now, you're not fine. This is kind of thing going on. Of course, once you get there, you get the moment of wonderful, and then it starts up again. I mean, surely we've been through this often enough to recognize it. Yeah. So you contemplate the energy behind the images that come up in the mind. That's how we develop insight. You're looking into these kind of perceptions, contemplate the energy there in the heart, the drivenness, the hungriness, the impatience, the demandingness, the way it closes your horizons down. Woo. Just pause. Nothing to be ashamed of, no guilt trips all over it. Just pause, be clear about it. Pause, wait. Feel your body, because that always helps to bring you out of the real trance of it all. Feel your body. Widen your attention so it's not in this trapped state. Widen, soften, breathing in, breathing out. What's happening right now with that irritation, with that craving, with that restlessness? And see if you can just breathe through that. So this is the way we start to kind of clear some of these programs. So these are aspects of the kind of intentions we hold in the mind. Mm. Yeah. So that the meditation is not purely like a technique of fastening attention on a particular object, but we're using an object as a place where our mind can start to unfold, where it opens up. Using something like breathing in and breathing out as a theme, which we stay with it and see how the mind starts to unfold around that, brings out its stuff, brings out its psychologies. And so that's the process of insight, process of calm, stabilizing tension, awareness around the breathing, and then insight, watching this stuff start to open up, arise. And then you need these other heart intentions towards clarity, towards honesty, towards discernment, towards generosity. Yeah. This is why when we do chant, in a way, we're chanting, honoring wisdom, truth, purity, lifting up, offering our voices, offering our bodies. It's a generous gesture, it's a devotional gesture. It's a heart practice to energize that particular thing. We're not just doing a kind of a cognitive technique. And through this, gradually what occurs over a long time is that these parami, these intentions, become much more firmly established. You know, so they become your norm. And the way that your mind and heart move is more in those senses. How can I serve? What's true? What's right? What's proper? What's helpful in this particular situation? And then the mind is a beautiful place to live in. So let's pause. And if you'd like to stand up for a few minutes and shake your legs around. And then we can have a sitting in the evening.